presents the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Julie Keel, and with me today is Mike McPeak.
Hello.
And Jeff Sire.
Hello, everybody.
Today we're going to be talking about the 1995 movie Johnny Mnemonic. Quick synopsis is in 2021, 5 short years from now, the whole world is connected by the gigantic internet and almost half of the population is suffering from the nerve attenuation syndrome, NAS. Johnny, with an implanted memory chip in his brain, was ordered to transport the overloaded information from Beijing to Newark, while Pharmacon Industries, supported by Yakuza, tries to capture him to get the information back. The low-tech group led by J-Bone tries to break the missing code to download the cure of NAS, which Johnny carries. Ah, yes, Keanu Reeves.
Well, I was going to say, before we get into the meat of the movie, or actually discussing the movie, what did you think about the future, you know, what he was, you know, because this book was written in, the movie was made in 1995, and I think, and it's based on a short story, which it doesn't exactly follow true to the story, but it was written in 82, I think it is. And so this is kind of Gibson's envisioning of the World Wide Web, written, what, nearly 30 years ago or something like that?
The World Wide Web was merely a year old when this... We had the internet since the 60s, but the World Wide Web... No, wait a minute. Yeah, no, the World Wide Web was started in 94. So,
yeah,
I think...
Yeah, somewhere in there.
So this was... Yeah, the World Wide Web was, you know, kind of a brave new world back then. And when this would have been under, you know, been written and under production, it was probably just this thing that people started hearing about, you know. So it wasn't, like, integrated into our lives like it is today.
Well, and even when the movie came out in 94, you know, the internet and the World Wide Web was, you know, it certainly wasn't what it isn't today. There was a lot of, it was the Wild West. It was a lot of, what can we do this with this wonderful new medium?
Yeah, and it was still in the realm of universities and the Department of Defense and research, you know, institutions, Smithsonian, you know, those types of organizations. And so, yeah, it wasn't the marketing that it is now. The graphics were just getting started. This was the world of animated GIFs and under construction pages, you know. Yeah, it was not what we know, which to me, the biggest teller of that, you know, the thing that dates this film immensely is the fact that 320 gigabytes would hold the entire research of, you know, Pharmacon. Yeah, no. 320 megabytes is like one website these days, depending on the website.
Well, yeah, so
gigabytes.
The developer, yeah. Well, and then the other thing too about, you know, the internet. This was one of the, you know, in the real world here, that was, this was one of the first movies that was kind of marketed towards the internet as it existed then. Because I was kind of reading here, I think they Sony, in conjunction with the film, they released video games and yeah, DOS, Mac, and Windows 3.1.
That is, oh dear, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that is bad. But they had, I think they had an online Internet Marketing and its new technology division promoted the film with online scavenger hunt, offering $20,000 in prizes. So, you know, even in that respect, this movie is kind of forward looking as far as using, you know, the internet for marketing and everything.
Had a reference to iPhones.
I thought I heard
something
in there.
But that was not the iPhone that we think of.
No,
I actually
totally not.
It was the VR headset.
Yep, it totally was not. But that, I mean, it just jumps right out at you when somebody 10 years prior to their launch says iPhone.
Yeah, I heard that and went, huh?
Right.
And then trying to figure out, I didn't get what it was. It was the headset, though, because they were slinging to do this stuff. They slung a lot of stuff around there. When he first gets the initial download, he pulls out all this stuff. And I guess they're trying to make it look, I don't know, intimidating, which I guess in the movie it's supposed to be. But, you know, he's pulling out all this stuff. You got a little Sony data disc there. You've got this thing that he has to jack into his head. You got the VR headset that you put on. He's got he goes through this whole procedure to do all this stuff. And I'm going, you know, I guess they're trying to make it look impressive, but I don't know. To me, it looked sort of odd.
Yeah, this movie is dated. I mean, it's meant to be sci-fi into the future. And it was, you know, predicting 20 years into the future when it was made, which there's a bad strategy for sci-fi. Never predict just 20 years into the future. But it this one. My takeaway from this movie is that this was probably a really good story, but the execution pretty well sucked.
Well, I've never read the story, but I did read the synopsis, and there was differences here. I wonder if I can find. Let's see. In the book or in the short story, the nerve attenuation syndrome didn't exist. And the main the Jane character was actually Molly Millions that we saw in Neuromancer. They changed some of the characters and you know, the way some of the stuff was done, so it doesn't necessarily follow true to the movie or to the story. So.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with the story, so when I say it's probably a good story, I mean the plot of this movie and what it was trying to, you know, do, the situation is brought up, the plot basically. I think the plot was reasonably solid and made for a good story. But again, the execution on this one just sucked.
Yeah. Is this where we take out our knives and cut the movie to bits now?
Or? Yeah, can we?
Well, I didn't think it was horrible.
No.
But horrible. And also, like, anybody who's from Toronto, like, it's filmed in Toronto, and they don't do a whole lot to hide it. So, like, there's a few places in the movie where there's very easily recognizable things, like the that kind of field hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That's Union Station, and anybody who rides the subway in Toronto has walked through that area.
Sure.
That they filmed that. It's like it's immediately recognizable.
Well, and I don't know that is counter to what they're doing, because there's a shopping mall there too that, you know, is immediately recognizable as well, I suspect. But that's kind of the point, where this was a familiar place that's kind of like, you know, post-apocalyptic. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know that they were required to make it unrecognizable.
Well, I think they did use the term near future. So, you know, I guess why not use things that you're familiar with? Or,
yeah.
You know, and hopefully in 20 years, that stuff won't have changed that much. So
I think the main kind of well, maybe not main story, but one of the main subplots of this whole thing and in the book is that this guy's a data courier. He couriers data in his head so that way he can go through any sort of passport checks, or there's no physical thing for them to intercept because he has the data in his head. But in order for him to hold that information, he's had to make a sacrifice, and the sacrifice that he's made is he has no memories of his childhood. So just – I think that's one of the kind of underlying themes for the book and to a lesser extent the movie, but that with technology sometimes we have to make this trade-off, and the trade-off that he's made is that he's given up his childhood in order to have this career that, you know, gets him where he wants to go. And
yeah, you know. $10,000 night hookers and laundered shirts.
Yeah.
That rant was painful to watch.
Yeah. It was. Well, and a little bit of nerd humor here. I just found it kind of interesting. So it's disease that people are getting from exposure to too much electronics and and so on. It's called nerve attenuation syndrome, NAS. Well, nowadays NAS stands for network attached storage system, which Johnny Mnemonic definitely isn't, because he's off the grid. I mean, that's the whole reason for his existence, is like, say, he can curry data between groups without it being exposed to, you know, prying eyes. And, you know, something else is kind of relevant today, even though it's not exactly spelled out, is basically encryption.
Yes.
Yeah, because the data's locked away, and you had – in this case, it was like basically past pictures. It wasn't a password per se, but he took like three random pictures while he was downloading the data. It was printed out, which I thought was amusing. But, you know, no transmitting – well, you had to fax it, but that's not exactly the internet. That's a point-to-point connection that could still be eavesdropped on, I guess. But So the person at the other end got these three pictures, and then in order to download the data, you know, you had to present it to him, and he had to match them up with what was stored in his head. And if they matched up, then you download the data. So, you know, it's a rudimentary basic form of, you know, encryption that we have today. I'm not even qualified to get into the whole discussion of how encryption works. But
I'm not either, but I have been through a few sessions on it, and that is kind of how it works. You have the key, and and you have to have – I thought that was really interesting, that basically the general premise behind that encryption there – is kind of still the general premise. The details are different, of course, but it's like you have the key when it's loaded, and only one person, you know, place, whatever, has the key when it's, you know, decrypted on the other end. So yeah, the three random picks. Okay, nowadays three would not be adequate, but the fact that they're picks too, especially depending on how you transmit them, pictures have. You know, eventually get turned into ones and zeros as well. So a picture turned into ones and zeros is a lot more than eight characters, which two of which must be, you know, letters, numbers, or capitals, you know, whatever. So that's kind of an interesting.
And if you use, you know, depending upon what you use for your data compression on your pictures, you know, nowadays it would be JPEG or something else, depending upon the compression, algorithm that you use, if you keep that secret also, I mean, they could intercept your ones and zeros, but without knowing how to recombine them into the proper order with your, your compressions algorithm there, that's another way of basically encoding your data so that even if somebody gets a hold of, like, say, the raw data, they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, so of all the things that don't stand up in this movie, that little detail stands up the best, I think, as far as technology goes.
Well, you know, especially, like I say, you know, kind of ripped from the headlines now with Apple being compelled to unlock the terrorist iPhone in California. You know, like I say, that became kind of relevant, I thought. And I guess that's what kind of made me notice it more, was he was even thinking about it, you know, like I say, back in I think this was a movie plot. I don't think it was in the short story, but still, I think he had something to do with it, the movie too. But, you know, even like, what is that, 20 some years ago, 22 years ago almost, I thought it was still, you know, forward looking.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, from a filmmaker's standpoint, you're not going to get anything right. I mean, you just don't. When you make these kind of movies where you're predicting stuff 20 years into the future, 50 or 400 years into the future, you're not going to get anything. Well, you might get a few things right, but that's the risk. That's why 2015 was such a big year, because Back to the Future was predicting 2015. And, you know, we had an episode where we talked about what they got right and what they got wrong, so...
But considering the year that this film came out, like 94, 95, they do some stuff with regards to the internet that really at that time, very few people knew much of anything about it. And they did do some stuff that was pretty, maybe realistic as a stretch, but like he was trying to retrieve the key for the data that was in his head. So he traced the call. Then he followed it back to the place in Newark, saw that it had gone to a fax, and he went on the went into the fax, accessed the memory buffer, and in an attempt to try and get the key, like that stuff was, you know, that's stuff that's doable today, right?
Yeah, that whole backtracking through things, that is the process.
Well, yeah, and as we were talking about that, then it kind of. One other thing that kind of popped my mind, I added to the end of our show notes here, was VR helmets, where you put that on. And I did think it was a little, I thought, potentially hokey, the way he was kind of waving his arms around and trying to do what looked like, sort of ninja moves on the internet or something like that. But the idea, I mean, but, you know, how would you, I mean, if we get to the point where we don't have the interfaces that we're used to, like keyboards and trackpads and, you know, all the other stuff that I'm looking around me here, and it is, you know, you don't have a physical device, how would you go about, manipulating the data.
I thought that one depiction of a passcode that was like a 3D puzzle that was in the shape of a triangle, I thought that was darned interesting as far as how the 3D virtual reality kinetic movement.
Well, and in some ways, that's not that different from the Android swipe passwords that they have now, right?
True. It's just a 3D version of it. Yep.
But, it did get me to thinking, like I say, watching him do that did look kind of weird. So does this mean we're going to look weird in the future? But
of course we're going to look weird in the future. We will look weird now. So what the heck?
Well, yeah, because if my dad, who passed away 30 some years ago, was to come and see us do all this stuff now, he'd, what's that? Are you people nuts or what? But
yeah.
It may be a generational thing. So we may look at these people, in the future and, we're kind of going, what's up with this stuff. But, it does, would you have a, if you're using this at work, would you have a virtual representation on your desk where you could just you wanted to send a letter, so you grab it kind of sounds like Microsoft's Bob, which.
Right.
Oh, Lord, that was horrible. But, they tried to take real world metaphors for the way we use computers and stuff so that, but I don't know if we have to do that. Maybe we just need to learn different ways of doing things. But I mean, how would you do that? How would you, if you wanted to send an email to somebody, would you grab a virtual notepad off your desk? Or, and I guess that's something for the interface gurus to try and figure out what is going to be the most effective way that doesn't make us look like complete dorks. To use, these VR headsets. Like I said, right now, they're just starting to come out. They're starting to make momentum. Nobody's really, had a hit. It's all early days, sort of like, we were when this movie came out with the internet and the World Wide Web, early days. And so everyone's envisioning things, and what's going to shake out, 20 years down the road is going to be interesting. But the idea of the virtual headset and using that as your primary interface, as opposed to what we use now, it kind of intrigued me. I just don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah, and that, I'm fully convinced that the keyboard is not the end-all be-all of interfaces, but human voice, I think, is the next level. But beyond that, I don't know. I mean, how do you get more efficient than that? Multitasking would be one, and that's what something you do. Your voice could say one thing, your hands could do something else. That type of thing. And maybe that's where the kinetic interface comes into play. But yeah, it's all on, and until we talk into actual brain implants, I guess one of the things they're looking at too, as far as human interface, is eyeball tracking. I know this happens to me all the time. I work on multiple monitors. And so I think I'm typing on one screen only to find out that it's actually taking place on a different one. So, that type of interface, they can bring that tomorrow, please. But yeah, the people who are imagining that, more power to you, because I really can't wrap my head around that.
Well, and even voice dictation, because I have a little trouble trying to bang out letters on my iPhone screen. So I try to use voice dictation, and it's got a ways to go yet, because I get some very interesting responses out of there. But then it also, even if they get to the point where it recognizes you, you're going to have to do some other things, because it's kind of a hassle to say, capitalize, say the word, lowercase, whatever, to try and get, your basically verbal formatting in there gets a little wonky at times. So maybe if there's a way that, it starts to read your expression, or context, this is a person's name, so I should. And sometimes the voice recognition gets that right. But, this is a person's name or something like that, or, get the punctuation and capitalization right. But, future interface design is still wide open, and I don't think there's any clear way moving forward yet.
Well, the one interface that we've seen twice now from Keanu Reeves movies is this jacking in the back of your head. And God, please, let's not go to that interface.
No, give me wireless.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that just looks, they always say you need it like one more hole in your head. Well, I don't need this like one more hole in my head. I have plenty the way it is. But, I just didn't think that was a, way to I guess for the time it seemed okay. But
yeah, and it's a science fiction movie. What do you want?
Sure.
That whole tapping into directly into your brain, That is actually an interface that, you know, they're currently pursuing. They mentioned the eyeball tracking. That's one of the ways that they try to read your mind. And then there are other, you know, brainwave patterns and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's going to be interesting to watch going forward.
For most of the tech, you could almost say that they really haven't missed the mark too much, because, like, even the stuff that we don't have today, we are still sort of heading in the direction that they show that's in this movie. I think some of the places where they did miss the mark is, you know, religion is just kind of continues to play a smaller and smaller part of our society, where here the street preacher, and it certainly looked like that was a bigger part of their society. Or it certainly seemed like it wasn't unusual to have these weirdo street preacher cyborgs.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that was the only religious figure in the movie to some extent. And obviously it was portrayed in a, you know, non-religious fashion.
He could have just been like a religious hitman sort of thing.
Right. So. Yeah. And he could have been a hitman who just wrapped himself in the religious, you know, moniker to make a name for himself. I mean, you had other people adopting certain personas. This guy just happened to adopt that one. So, honestly, I don't think this movie makes much of any statement about religion other than that there's religious wackos in every time period.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like I say, I didn't even go that far. Because you have all sorts of, well, cults of personality on the internet and in the real world. You know, let's not forget like Jim Jones and that kind of people. But again, he was religious too. But I mean, I think it's just the fact that people want to gravitate towards somebody that.
But did you see any followers? He had no followers.
No.
He was just a hitman. Right. Who happen to use crucifixes and shepherd's hooks, you know, I mean,
right.
Like I say, I don't think he makes any statement whatsoever about religion other than that was his persona. It's like saying he was like a superhero and that was his costume, you know?
Yeah. It was more like his shtick.
Right.
And you know, I there's a few characters in here that I found, you know, or actors I saw, Dolph Lundgren,
who was the preacher, yeah.
Right, and so I reading through stuff, and I see that this was the last movie he made up until he made, was it The Expendables in 2010? So he took a break from acting there.
I would, too, after this one.
Yeah, because I'm looking at that character going, oh, God. You know, because considering he was a preacher, that was kind of an odd choice. But, you know, that character was kind of But then I also saw Henry Rollins in there, which – I've seen him in different places, and he kind of fascinates me.
He's a really cool dude, without a doubt. And that's where I decided this movie was total complete shit, because whoever was in charge of this movie took a couple of people who actually are kind of decent actors and can pull some things off and made them look bad, too. You know, well, I've seen Henry Rollins do a good job of acting and come off in a believable way, not in this show.
Yeah, and I've seen a few of his things, and I was seriously wondering if they had him on Prozac for this role.
Yeah,
or something.
Really,
because he's got kind of a wild man persona to him, and this guy was not wild. He was playing like kind of the quiet nerd, not exactly,
yeah.
But toned down. I mean, you know, this certainly wasn't a raging maniac or anything like that.
Yeah, and he really wasn't the tough guy, although he would, you know, obviously to survive, you know, under the conditions he was working in, you had to have been a tough guy. But he does usually play tough guy roles.
And maybe he wanted to change. I don't know. But like I say, that just kind of struck me. And then you had Ice-T in there too, which I thought he did a good enough job.
Matter of fact, he was the one guy in this that I thought actually did do a decent job.
Yeah. I don't know if it would be a lot different from, you know, from his kind of rapper roots.
Yeah, and maybe it was just that the actor fit the character much better.
Yeah.
Because the rest of them were all felt kind of, you know, like shoved into these roles, but. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Keanu Reeves, and I think that people don't like his acting, but I think it's that they cast him, or he tends to be cast in these roles where there isn't supposed to be any emotion, like Neo in the Matrix.
Right.
And this character is another one. He's supposed to be like sort of a washed out shell of a human being. And maybe that's just because he is a bad actor or what, but like he seems to play those roles really, really well, where he has just kind of like almost no emotion. Like, have you guys seen John Wick?
Yes.
Yeah. Perfect in that. He's this guy who his wife's died and he has no, it's like he's lost his soul.
Yeah.
It's a perfect role. And he plays that role really, really well. And I think that's what he was trying to do here. And I think I liked it.
I agree. I think he nailed that role in here. There were a couple of times when emotion broke through. And the rant about the $10,000 night hookers in the press, that was one place where it was like, that was shit. I mean, that scene was utter shit. But I think the one thing that bugged me about Keanu does a lot of his acting through just pregnant pauses, just that stare of, you know, that stare. Yeah. And this movie, when you did that so many times, one minute it would say, you have to do these things quickly. You have 24 hours to live. And the next minute he would just be staring. And I'm like, stop. It's got to be one or the other. So I don't fault the actor for that. That to me, the faults of this movie, in my opinion, that it's shit, fall on the director. That those things were just not necessary and not portrayed, you know, just... There was a lot that could have been done differently to make these people in these roles do a better job.
Well, yeah, and like I said, you know, I think it was also like post-production too, because
some real bad green screen stuff.
Well, that, and then I think they kind of after they filmed it, they kind of chopped it up and did things to it to make it more mass appeal for marketing. So, you know, that probably didn't help. I think the story itself could have been done a little better, but I think also the post-production part was left something to be desired. And because Longo, who's the director in Gibson, they'd envisioned making an art film on a small budget. So they wanted to – it started out as an artsy $1.5 million movie and end up being a $30 million movie because we couldn't get $1.5 million. There's just something.
This is the only movie this guy's ever directed, and he's known as a sculptor more than anything. Like, yeah, he's this really weird. So, okay, his Wikipedia entry is Robert Longo is an American painter and sculptor. Longo became a rising star in the 1980s. For his Men in Cities series, which depicted sharply dressed men and women writhing in contorted emotion. So, like, I think they got this guy more for kind of like the atmosphere that he was going to be bringing to it rather than, like, I bet this guy really didn't know what he was doing when it came to directing. They probably had the assistant director or whatever, he was just kind of like propping him up, and that they wanted this, and like this movie has a very distinct feel to it. You can't deny that,
right? Yep.
And that's probably why they got him to direct it.
Yeah, he just should have had maybe a co-director said, "You do style, I'll do direction."
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
And to me, that this then becomes a movie that begs for a remake, because I do think that the story behind this is a good science fiction story. You know, that whole trade-off between, you know, the short-term gain, I want to take this job and be this data courier, and I had to give up my childhood memories because of that, and I'm risking my life because of that, and I'm going to save the world, and you know, all these other things that play into it. Those are good science fiction themes. So somebody needs to remake this movie.
Yeah, and then throw in, like I say, the internet and security and, you know, what's, you know, privacy versus security. You know, there's a few things that, you know, that's happening today. And I don't know, maybe that would date it, because maybe 20 years down the road they're going, this was a thing. But there is some things I think that could be explored, because I think security on the internet's going to be an issue for a long, long time. So I think you throw that in there, explore some of that stuff, the personal side, the technology side, you know, maybe flesh it out a little bit and connect it a little bit better, because there are times it seems kind of you know, disjointed or whatever, but tie it together. And I think they could, with the in the right hands, they could make a decent movie out of it.
Yeah, I've been rewatching Dark Matter because I enjoyed it so much, and I had to imagine, you know, Johnny Mnemonic being done by the people who are doing Dark Matter, going, oh, that could really be fun to watch. So yeah, I like the story. I like the underlying story and the things that it's driving at. It's just the execution of this one was, I mean, for myself personally, and this is only an hour and a half movie, and I pretty much can endure anything for an hour and a half. But there were times that I just had to like look away, literally, because it's like, oh my God, really? So whatever.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, kind of back to the tech part, what did you guys think of a cybernetically enhanced dolphin?
Why would you bother? I think he's probably good enough the way it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, they needed something that could read minds, so then their thinking was, well, do encryption. And so the plot then became, well, they were using – the Navy was using him to intercept, you know, be around submarines to intercept their technology and whatever, decode it and use it as a weapon. But, and you know, the scary part is,
you said Dolph Lundgren. Are we talking?
No. He said dolphin.
Oh, I heard Dolph Lundgren.
Oh no.
So sorry.
No. Well, and you know, enunciation, I'll work on that. the cybernetically enhanced dolphin.
Yeah, that was awesome actually.
Well, you know, and like I say, well, and the kind of the weird thing is this, it was actually in the short story, but in the short story, the dolphin was addicted to heroin.
Which could be the case in the movie as well. You don't know. I mean, you got the impression. I mean, if somebody said that dolphin was an addict, I'd go, okay, sure. Why not? Everybody else there was.
Well,
I think this is also kind of a victim of the time that this came out that, no computer will be as powerful as the human brain, so we'll have some way to harness a human brain, and then – you know, then we get to a point of like, you know, like now we look at it as like, well, why would you do that?
And that's interesting too. That's interesting because yes, we were looking at, we needed the human brain to do this data transfer. And now think of, the Johnny Depp one we saw. Transcendence, where basically we need to put the human brains into the computers because the computers are going to be so much better and bigger. So that has tipped.
It's almost,
in those 20 years.
Complete 180-degree turn from this. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
There's some of the stuff that's in here.
At least they acknowledge the fact that humans aren't the only sentient beings out there. They did acknowledge, you know, dolphins. And so there was that little bit in there that, you know, we're not the sole proprietors of intelligence. It's just the yardstick that you use.
That's true. And I guess that's a dolphin's view of post-apocalyptic, you know, survival then too. In a fish tank, you know, jacked up on heroin and doing cybersecurity. Wow. Anyway.
Yeah, I just, like I said, I thought that was kind of interesting. That Ted was actually in the short story. So I thought it was kind of, interesting to see how he had envisioned that.
Yeah, it's there's a lot in here about that's kind of Max Headroom-ish a little bit.
Yeah, I got that vibe at certain spots too, I think. And I forget which parts they are now, but yeah, I was looking at it and thinking, yeah, I did see a little Max Headroom. And again, that was the 80s, right? So it could have had a little bit of an influence on it. But, and again, this is all early days of computers and the internet and how we were envisioning things. And like I said, I know there was a couple times I got that vibe, and I'm just drawing a blank right now. But
Well, I know Max Headroom and Tron a little bit too. Some of the depictions of going through the internet, you know, the VR type stuff was, that's when I started to get some of the Max Headroom vibes and Tron vibes, and this was a to me, those two did that better than this one did.
And they also dealt a lot with implants, which is something that we really haven't gotten to yet. So, like, Johnny Mnemonic had the data implant in his skull. The women who were the bodyguards had some sort of reflex enhancement, and they were super strong. And and that is something that, you know, we're talking about more and more. I know we've talked about, like, the runners who have their lower legs replaced with blades and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah, and what's allowed and what's not. And that whole doping thing played out here, too, because the one dude, Ralphie, stupid name, anyway, had, two bodyguards. And then there was this other one who wanted to become one of his bodyguards, but she wasn't allowed because she was doped up. So it's like the IOC, said these are the doping rules for bodyguards. If you're doped, you can't be. So that was kind of interesting to me because, one of the motivations to dope is because you get better than you can be without it. And the way this movie was depicting it, it was kind of the opposite.
Well, I mean, even in the real world, you have doping. You've had people that use steroids and stuff. And there's consequences. Short-term gains, what's the long-term, consequences?
I'll get that, yeah. We're talking a world here without ethics, talking, I need a bodyguard. I want the best bodyguard possible. If that means you're going to take drugs so you can guard me for 3 years, and these guys who don't take drugs can guard me for 10 years, I don't care. I want the best guards I can get. Do you need drugs? Thank you. I'll provide them. That's the kind of world that this was being portrayed in. So that was kind of a little strange to me.
Yeah, and I get the feeling that this was a world where people really weren't too concerned about their social security.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there wasn't a child or an elderly person to be seen anywhere.
A few children. Well, some of it was this flashback.
Yeah, there's no children. Yeah.
Yeah, not too many. Yeah, so this was, it was supposed to be a bleak place. But, as far as the implants, again, we're still, even now, we're still kind of early stages. You guys were talking about the runners with their, artificial legs. I was also thinking about diabetics with, and that's more of a implanted pump.
Right.
But, I mean, still, that's something that even 10 years ago was just starting to,
argue hip replacements, knee replacements. Right. That's all.
Sure.
Implants. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the non-enhancing implants. Let's put it that way. I mean, you're getting a better version, like, say, a deteriorated joint. You put an artificial one in there, it's a better version. But right now, you're not gaining any special skills or leverage from something like that. It's when we start to get to the point that you start enhancing these implants, so you become a better or improved person, that being subjective. I think that's where it starts to get interesting. Like, maybe by now, bionic eyeballs, because right now, I'm getting to the point where I think I need to improve my reading glasses. And I'm just sitting there thinking, man, just to have bionic eyeballs that, would adjust and you don't have to go see the eye doctor and get a new prescription all the time. There's certain allure to a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. And that it's, remind me if this is here or it's just about here, but HD contact lenses. It's not quite an implant, but it's one step away from that. And the idea of we are going to implant contact lenses into people, laser surgery is just one step. But cataract surgery, good Lord, you pull people's cataracts out and put new ones in. We somewhat recoil from all of these cybernetic things being depicted in science fiction. Yet, you can get LASIK for, 20% off. Bring in your coupon, So it's we're getting to be schizophrenic, I suppose might be the word, about these implants too. You know, on one side we think, oh my gosh, that's bad. We're going to lose our humanity. Are we still going to be us when we're all, you know, like 90% of our parts have been replaced? And on the other hand, it's like, oh, my hip hurts. I think I need a new one. What do you got? You know, plastic, metal, what's the latest technology? Oh, it's got microchips in it to help, you know, regulate, you know, whatever. Oh, that sounds terrific. You know, let's put that in. So, you know, on a grand and glorious scale, it sounds frightening. And on an individual decision-making scale, it's a lot more appealing, which means the grand and glorious scale follows.
Well, and I have no problem, you know, you call it kind of schizophrenic. I don't have a problem with that per se, as long as it doesn't become, society doesn't become paralyzed by it. But it's good to have a healthy skepticism, ask some questions, because, you know, like it was portrayed in this movie, you know, the technology, there was a natural cure out there, but the corporation didn't want to let it out because they wanted to make more money off of selling the treatment than they were giving the cure. So then it becomes, you know, the kind of the hidden cost with all this stuff. If the corporation controls it, you know, we've seen a few of these things pop up, not maybe not in the medical field so much, but I think we talked about it when we did Demon and Freedom TM, that, you know, some tractors have DRM built into it. Well, what happens when you get to the point where your hip replacement or your bionic eye or whatever has DRM built into it, and, you know, suddenly that part that's in your body is not yours, it actually belongs to somebody else and they have rights to it that you don't? That opens up, you know, an entirely different can of worms when it comes to this stuff.
I think I mentioned that a couple episodes ago, that the howstuffworks.com got .com guys did how, I think it was biometrics works, or how the human genome works, and they were saying that we are probably not that far away from like toilets that will scan your urine as you're peeing into the toilet, and that will connect to an app on your iPhone that will update your current, you know, blood sugar levels and all this other stuff. That, you know, these multiple ways to track your own personal health.
Right.
You know, like kind of like super Fitbits, but where they're actually looking at, you know, the genome and like taking a very close look in your biometrics.
Right. And the converse of that, or the, you know, the continuation of that, is that that data is fed back into some system who says, you know, what you really need to be eating is this, that, and the other thing in these portions. Here's your menu for the day. We'll ship it to you in your HelloFresh box, and there you go. And so, therefore, we eliminate a lot of – we have the potential to eliminate a lot of, you know, like lifestyle-based diseases type things. But the point of Johnny Mnemonic is, whose interest is that? You know, if PharmaCorp or PharmaCom – is making money by selling, you know, treatments to diseases, and then suddenly we eliminate the diseases, you know, they don't have a lot of incentive to do that. And that, to me, is why Johnny Mnemonic has a lot of potential as far as a story and as far as a remake goes, because that's a legitimate topic that, you know, is still relevant today.
Well, the personal versus corporate interest, because, you know, kind of going back to the diagnosing toilet there, if you were to use that information for yourself, that would be fine. Like I say, if you wanted to subscribe to a service that says, you know, we need to change your – here's a, you know, a change in your diet to correct this stuff or whatever, that would be fine. But not that I'm paranoid or anything, but let's envision a world where suddenly the insurance companies get a hold of this information and they say, you know, in order to reduce your rates, we're going to insist that you do this, and suddenly you lose your personal freedom. You know, whether, you know, it's for your own benefit or not is beyond the point. What if you lose your personal freedom because of somebody else's greater interest than your personal freedom? Like I say, I think that could work in this story too.
How about when your toilet reports you to the police because you did illegal drugs?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Like I say, not that I'm paranoid, but try to envision all futures before you, you know, rush headlong into it and try to anticipate things. Again, there's nothing wrong. I mean, if your life is controlled by paranoia, that's wrong. But to just sit there and say, here's some possibilities we should, you know, think about this and maybe try to deal with them before, you know, suddenly we have to deal with this, you know, three-headed monster that we've created and we're trying to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, that, like I say, that's why I think Johnny Mnemonic, as much as I think it's a stinker of a movie, I think it's still a good story and still relevant. And I really would like to see a remake of it, because those issues, I mean, this the plot line in here is one of those ways you explore those issues. You know, if this is the situation, you know, these are potential consequences of it, side effects of it, you know.
Well, what we need to do is just get the Europa Report people, or like you said, the Dark Matter TV people, you know, in this, and you know, take the story as it is and rework it. Like I think, yeah, there is some potential there. It just needs to be brought out.
Okay, total tangent, but I don't know if you guys heard the news, but Rod Roddenberry is actually going to have an active role in the 2017 CBS Star Trek that's coming out. So, speaking of, yeah, let's just cross our fingers and hope his voice is listened to.
Now, is this a role as in, like, creative consultant?
I'm not exactly sure. Somehow executive producer came in my head, but I'm not sure what the exact title was.
Let's say, some sort of input on the production side. To what extent, if it's just as an advisor or if he actually gets a yay, nay, you know, on some of this. And like I just saw the headline. I didn't drill down to read it, but I saw that he was going to be in the
fact that they brought him on at all gives me some semblance of hope. I mean, because they didn't have to do that.
No.
So the fact that they bothered to do that is an encouraging sign in my book.
It should keep us old Star Trek fans happy to kind of, you know, it doesn't necessarily go back to the roots, but there are certain values that are timeless that need to be preserved. Yeah. Not preserved, but explored.
Yeah.
Because even some things that, you know, the old Star Trek held near and dear, you know, I think it's ripe for speculation and talking about.
Yeah.
Do it in the right way.
Well, we will always have ethical challenges, and science fiction is one of the best ways to talk through and think about in a safe way the ethical challenges and explore the potential possible consequences of decisions. So, Johnny Mnemonic does that to some extent. It meets that criteria.
Yeah, just like I say, we wish that and I'm trying to think, for 94, the, you know, the whole the graphic side of special effects.
You know, I was looking at the end. I was waiting to see the long list of digital artists or whatever. And I really didn't. I saw a couple of shops that they hired. And I kind of know, I kind of remember what it was like producing graphics stuff in the mid-90s. And, oh, my God, this would have been massive quantities of time to do. I mean, today you could probably do some of those, you know, scenes reasonably quickly, you know, whatever. But back then that was challenging, time intensive. And so, I was waiting for like these huge screens of digital artists. And I think all I really saw was that they hired out to like three or four shops to do it. I'm like, oh, really? And those people get no credit, but oh, well.
Well, I think, you know, they're probably dated, but I think they're probably otherwise they hold up well enough.
They do hold up well enough. I mean, compare that to was it Transcendence with the bookcases trying to show time space warps and whatever. That concept, we don't have a better visual, you know, meme, I guess, to portray that. So the things that were portrayed in Tron and in Johnny Mnemonic and in Transcendence is the best we can imagine, I guess, as far as how to portray those things visually. It might be different if you could actually do a VR experience of it, but when you're talking 2D display on a screen type things, that's, you know, I don't know how you would portray some of that stuff visually, especially the stuff in Transcendence where it's just like, you know, advanced math. So how do you turn that into a picture on the screen?
Okay, and I just had my Inception moment here where we get to the point where they remake Johnny Mnemonic and then we watch it on a VR headset.
Yeah, that's probably it right there. That would be a thing.
Yeah, that would be the, you know, the tiger eating its tail or whatever. So
okay, speaking of tails, I have to mention the laser whips. Yes. Those were most of the weapons shown in this were, you know, reasonably conventional weapons, you know, guns, grenades, that
projectiles.
Yeah, that type of thing. Yeah. Except the laser whip, which it was both like a whip and a like string saw type thing.
In the book, it's called a monofilament whip. I read the short story a long time ago, so as I recall. And also, this is kind of like a hallmark of cyberpunk books. It's, you know, personal, like, high-tech modifications on to people's bodies is one of the things you see a lot in cyberpunk novels, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the thumb is an artificial thumb, and it acts as a control weight for the whip that's inside that spools out. And it's just like a single molecular strand of wire. So when you slash it at things, there's certain things that it cuts through really easy, and one is like other people.
Right, yeah, and, human flesh.
But then you saw when it got to that metal gate that got closed in front of him, he couldn't cut through it.
Right.
Although I seem to remember him, and maybe it wasn't a metal door, but I seem to remember at the beginning where Johnny's doing his initial upload of information to his head, where they take the loop and cut a hole through the door. Yeah. And again, maybe it was a wood door, maybe it wasn't a metal door, but... yeah, I saw that. You know, it is kind of an interesting thing, personal defense thing. You know, you could piano wire people with it and do things like that. And it would be – or you could use it as a whip, which for close combat could be – it would be a good thing, I think, especially if somebody's coming at you with a knife. If you can keep some distance and, like, cut their hand off, that would be kind of awesome.
Yeah, which he did. There he goes. All right. You know, so that was the most, you know, other than all of the data storage, post-apocalyptic stuff, that was the one piece of technology that kind of stood out as from the rest, I guess, in my mind. It was like, oh, no, that's different. Haven't really seen something like that laser whip out of your thumb before.
Well, yeah, at least we haven't seen anything. And it's those kind of inventive pieces of... future tech that somebody throws in there that makes you go, okay, you know, it gets you to think a little bit. It seemed okay. It could have been done stupid and hokey, but I think it was probably done well enough.
Yeah.
And just enough so you to go, you know, if I was an assassin running around killing people, you know, I've sold my soul to the devil and, you know, I really don't care. Yeah, I would probably have one of those built into my thumb.
Yeah, and I'm using the term laser quite loosely here.
Yeah.
It wasn't a laser. It was just this thing that they portrayed as a strand of light, basically. Because, again, you have to portray it visually. If it's a monofilament, one molecular atom wire, how you can do that in a movie? So, yeah, you know.
Something that thin you're not going to see. So they had that glowy effect so you could at least kind of – it wasn't magic, people. It was this thing.
Yeah, so – but, yeah, it's – some of the other, you know, stuff, you know, we didn't really, I mean, it was portrayed as post-apocalyptic. We didn't, did they talk about why, what brought the apocalypse?
I don't think this is really truly post-apocalypse.
Yeah.
This is more like post-apocalypse is generally there's one event that is, you know, happened and then the world's crap after that.
Right.
This is like a kind of like a moral decline of society sort of scenario.
So do you think it was the NAS that caused that? Is that the point?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it is one event in this book or in the movie either. Like it's,
yeah, and to me that was the one thing that really was confusing. It's like, it's seriously, it was only portrayed as 20 or 30 years in the future. And, you know, suddenly the world has changed completely and there was no explanation of that. And, no, you know, it looked like war or nuclear bombs had gone off or something.
Well, I think it was basically class warfare. You're kind of looking at the degradation of society. And, you know, you had the the low techs that were shunning technology because they were using crossbows, they were using knives, they were using, you know, so they kind of shied away, although I think at different times they did, you know, use some technology, but they were trying to shy away from it. And I think it was just this, I think it was his way of kind of portraying in the future the haves and have nots. It's the digital haves and have nots. And, you know, and I think he was trying, you know, the story was trying to say, you know, when you have that sort of divide amongst people, and I think it was accelerated by the NAS, but, you know, when you have that kind of divide between people, what, you know, even on a digital level or a, you know, computer level like that, what's it going to do to people? You know, how is it going to affect society? And I think maybe that's what we were seeing, that you had some people running away from technology, and you had the others who were trying to embrace it. And maybe almost enforce it. I didn't see any, you know, that they weren't forcing people to take implants, but they certainly weren't doing anything to accommodate the low techs or their lifestyle. There was no real respect for them. They were kind of looked down upon by society.
Yeah, and see, I didn't get right. the, as much as their name for them was low tech, I didn't necessarily get the opinion or the impression that they were anti-tech. They were anti-establishment. They were, you know, right. on the fringe, but they certainly had their own form of technology that they were using and controlling and protecting. So it wasn't like they were Luddites. They were just the fringe element.
Well, and I think they were steering away from the cyber part of technology.
Yeah.
They were more embracing the physical technology.
Yeah, I think they definitely understood the dangers of it perhaps more than the rest of, you know, the mainstream.
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to speculate here that I think what they were saying was their sort of technology is personal. You have a crossbow, you have all the stuff that you can make, you're in control of.
I think that's the issue, is that they had control as opposed to the other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, whereas the cyber stuff, you have corporations in charge of it. And, you know, I guess that was the point of the NAS, was that, you know, this is a disease that, you know, you couldn't – until the very end of the movie, you didn't – spoiler – you didn't realize there was a, you know, cure for this. And so this makes people feel helpless, at least by, you know, embracing their form of technology. They feel like they have some control over their lives.
Yeah. And again, that's why I think this movie should be remade, because that's a legitimate thing for science fiction to talk about. You know, the technology, who has control over it, who has the scope of it, and how, you know, how you make that decision and, you know, and the consequences. So, yeah, cool.
So all we need to do is to get some Hollywood executive to listen to our little podcast here and then take it seriously and remake it.
Awesome. Yeah. Yep. No doubt. So anyway, well, so is there any of the technology that was in this that you guys want for your own purposes?
Crossbows fascinate me. I don't know what I'd use it for, but they fascinate me.
Yeah, well, that's not necessarily all that high tech, so there you go. You can get those.
Right.
I do like the idea of jacking directly into the internet through your head. It's not practical or anything, but I think it'd be neat to do.
Yeah.
Could you imagine the efficiency downturn, you know, in companies if people started doing that? But yeah, it seems awesome.
Yeah, and that does seem to pop up time and time again. Heck, that was even in Hyperion with, you know, the jacking and whatever. But I guess the piece of technology that I would like is kind of the VR headsets, that whole 3D passcode and, you know, exploring as, and again, now that I think about that, I didn't make that connection before, but it does, some of those graphic scenes where he's going through the network are very similar to what was described in Hyperion as far as actually going through the network. So I'll take that. I wouldn't mind, you know, like going down deep into reality. So yeah, anyway.
You could get lost.
You could definitely get lost. Again, go back to Hyperion. That was the risk there. I mean, once you got in, you never wanted to get out. It was its own drug. So, yeah. Anyway, cool story. Not the best execution, I don't think. Lot of potential. Worth watching. I'm glad we watched this. I consider this kind of a must-see type of movie because it portrayed something in a particular time early on in the World Wide Web that, you know, there are still things that are in it that are relevant today. So,
yeah, it's not for the production values that you watch it. It's for the thinking part.
It's kind of like why you go back and watch Soylent Green and Logan's Run. It's like, you know, they're actually not that great, but the story and the message and that is worth, you know, the time to watch it. Anyway, so I think that's going to wrap up this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com, where there's some cool space junk available for purchase. But you can pop into the forums there. Please pop into the forums there. Take part in the conversation. We'll have a thread up for Johnny Mnemonic. So if you've watched it, have an opinion, I'd love to hear what you have to say about it. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. If you have ideas or comments, please send them to greetings at scifitechtalk.com. And reviews on iTunes are always welcome. Mike, where can folks find you?
Yeah, I can be found on Twitter at DSCChipman, and I have my About.me page at About.me/MikeMcPeak. That's MCPEEK.
And Jeff, how about you?
People can follow me on Twitter at BroncoSire. That's SYER.
And you can swim around the internet and find me on Twitter at Julie Kuehl, JulieKuehl. And links to the other blogs, podcasts, and whatever else I might have going on can be found at about.me/JulieKuehl. Next week, we're going to be covering the movie Alien Outpost, which is also known as Outpost 37. And the quickest probably synopsis we've ever had describes this one as a documentary crew follows an elite unit of soldiers in the wake of an alien invasion. So tune in next week to find out more. But that's it for this show, and we'll see you in the future.
Quirky matter. It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.